I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Michael Levine is a Broadway performance coach and sheet music expert. He's also worked as a musical director, pianist, vocal coach and singer all over the world. He is very much a music man. His connection to Australia has been long, with Michael hosting many Aussie performers when they have ventured to New York to explore the cabaret world or Broadway as performer or audience member. Michael, too, has been down under frequently as a performance coach for many theatre programs and schools around the nation. I've known Michael for 30 years, his doorway to Australia having been opened by one of our celebrated musical directors and supervisors. That story is fascinating and wonderful. Michael is also known for owning one of the largest privately held sheet music collections in the world and is frequently called upon for his extensive knowledge. I caught up with Michael in New York in January for another jolly reunion, and his always entertaining and enthusiastic anecdote.
Two concerts, one in March and one in April. Very interesting subjects of, you know, I'll let you bring that up to me.
Oh, no, you can bring it up now. It's started. We're on air. Michael Levine.
Hello, Peter, and happy to be here. Thank you.
Perhaps get a little bit closer.
I'll start by saying that I do a lot of concerts at 54 Below, and Rob Schneider, who does them with me, he hosts them. Sometimes I host them, but he hosts them. We have a series called Broadway Bound, which we've done six, seven, where we do songs from shows that were supposed to come to Broadway but didn't come to Broadway. Right. And we've done quite a few. I sang a song from Arthur, you know, Arthur the movie with Dudley Moore. And there was a musical by Michael Skloff and Marta Crane. You know, it played at good speed and it wasn't successful. And they said, there's no money in musicals. Let's write a sitcom. I've got an idea. Six friends in a coffee bar, and they created Friends. But before Friends, they wrote Arthur. And somebody dropped out of our show at the last minute. So with 1 hour notice, Rob said, can you sing Fun from Arthur? And I went, yeah, I've been giving it to students for years. So I did that. And then after me was some guy named Stephen Schwartz, who sang Chanson from Beggar's Wife, because that didn't come to Broadway. So
it's a great premise for a concert too, isn't it? I remember those recordings of Lost in Boston.
Exactly what we're doing.
Those musical numbers that were dropped from shows.
Well, these weren't cut songs. This is the other series that Bruce Kimmel did besides Lost in Boston, which was called Unsung Musicals or something else. He had two series. Lost in Boston were songs that were cut. We're not doing songs that were cut. We're doing songs from shows that were supposed to come to Broadway, but the show didn't come to Broadway.
Right.
But there's another series. I want to start a series called The Kindest Cut. And all songs cut from shows. And I want to do it The Hayes. I'm just putting it out there. And The Alex or whatever, somewhere in Melbourne. Chapel of Chapel. And an Ellington Room. I've a ton of obscure cut songs from shows that you would never know that are wonderful. There's a musical called Bring Back Birdie, the sequel to Bye Bye Birdie.
Yep. Yep.
I went to Columbia, and where I might say I was the same class as Barack Obama.
So written by Charles Strauss.
And Lee Adams. Yeah. I was the same class as Barack Obama, go figure. I was also the same class as Janine Tesoriero, which is her real name, Janine Tesori. She was at 18, we were 18 together at college at uni. She was at Barnard and I was at Columbia. So I was taking a course with Lee Adams, who was the lyricist of Bye Bye Birdie. He's still alive. He's 99. Charles Strauss is still alive at 96. I think something about writing musicals, John Cander's 96, Sondheim lived to be 91. I mean, it's a good thing. Larry Grossman is a wonderful composer, is 85. It's good for your health that you live a nice long life. But there was a song that was cut from so we saw Bring Back Birdie. I saw it 7 times because I would go every week. I could just, it only played, it previewed like Merrily did. Merrily previewed for 5 weeks and then played 2 weeks in performance. Bring Back Birdie also played around 5 weeks and then played 4 performances. But I saw it 7 times. I could go to the box office and said, I want to buy a standing room ticket. And they didn't sell standing room at the theater. So that was the code for selling me an orchestra seat for $7 back in 1981, when that was a lot of money. And I saw it a lot, and then I went, and then Lee, I went to visit Lee, because Steve Ross, you know, the cabaret pianist, absolutely, Steve Ross, yeah, one of my best friends, he was friendly with Lee, and he said, let's drive out to Briarcliff Manor in Westchester, around 45 minutes from here, to visit Lee. And he was, at the time, 97, 98, whatever, and I heard the voice from the garage, and I was like, oh my God, the years just melted away. It was great seeing him. He uses a walker or a cane, but he's sharp as a tack, unlike Charles, who sometimes forgets things. And John Cantor is right on top of things, still working on shows. It's amazing.
That's extraordinary. So how often do you do these concerts, and where are they in New York?
Maybe every couple of months. There was one that was scheduled for December, and Rob just will send me a text saying, December 8th, and I'm like, oh no, I'm in Europe. So I thought he wouldn't do it without me, but he did. With a pianist, it was apparently okay. But and he didn't really use a lot of stars in that one, but that was done. So it's every maybe 3-4 months. It's whenever, they always sell well. So the people at 54 Below will go to Rob and say, we just had somebody back out of a show. We have this date available. We need you to put it in there because we know it's going to sell well. So I'm like, he told me March 5th. I said, I have tickets for a show. I'll change them. I'll do it. And we like to go to stars if we can, you know, get good people.
Well, it's a great thing to see if anyone from Australia is in New York at that particular time.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's March 5th. And then in April, this young podcaster named Charles Kirsch, he's 16 years old. He has a broad backstage babble. He's interviewed everybody from Joel Grey to Chita Rivera, almost 200 interviews. And he co-hosts with Rob, the Broadway Bound show. He's doing a show with me at the end of April at 54 Below, celebrating songs from the shows that are on the walls at Joe Allen's. Do you know about the restaurant Joe Allen's? And the posters are all flop musicals. So not flop, not things that didn't come in, which is what Broadway Bound is. These are shows that played on Broadway but were not successful. And he has a lot of original cast members, like Willie Falk, who was the original Chris in Miss Saigon on Broadway. Before that, around 6 years before that, he was in a musical called Marilyn, an American Fable, a musical about Marilyn Monroe. And he played Marilyn's biggest fan, who sings a song called You Are So Beyond, which is a very popular audition song I've been giving out for almost 40 years. And he's in your trailer, and he looks around, and he sings to the audience, You Are So Beyond Anything I Can Imagine. It's a good song. He's going to sing that. We have things like that. We have people who are in these shows recreating their original performances.
Terrific. Earlier, you listed a whole lot of venues in Australia. You are, after all, an honorary Australian.
I really feel like that.
You've spent a lot of time in Australia. But how did that connection, a lot of people would be keen to know, how did that connection with Australia first begin?
I mean, I'd always loved, and so many people I know, when I talk about it, they go, oh, it's a place I've always wanted to go. It's a very common thing. Yet every Aussie is usually in the States or in Europe, always traveling. But in 1985, I was on my way to the videotaping of Sunday in the Park with George. Sondheim had gotten me a ticket, and I was at Arby's. There was a roast beef shop at 49th and Broadway, and I was sitting with my friend. And we looked over, and we saw a couple on the other side of the restaurant, and he had the vocal selections to Merrily We Roll Along, which were fairly new at the time. And I said, let's go chat with him. It was a young pianist from Sydney who hadn't really done much. He'd maybe depped on a couple of shows. And he gave me his card, and I stayed in touch with him, and actually got him a Sunday in the Park with George CD signed to Guy Simpson from Stephen Sondheim. And he was very good. And he assisted Michael Tyak on the Australian premiere of Company in 1986 at the Sydney Theatre Company, I think?
Yes.
With John O'May. And Tony Sheldon and Geraldine Turner and Michael Turgut and
Marion Ramsdell,
Natalie Moscow, maybe. I mean, it was like everybody was in it, and he sent me a program that everybody signed, and I have to figure out where that is. And then I get, and Guy told me he was starting to MD shows, and I was like, great, but he hadn't done anything really then, And then I get a letter in the mail, or a fax. I think it was a letter. You don't know me, but guy says you might be able to help me. My girlfriend and I are coming to New York. And it was Ian White and his girlfriend, Leanne O'Farrell, who at the time were just young kids, hadn't done much. And maybe they were in Cats. It's about Dancing Cats now. And they
Cats,
said,
you know.
Cats, you know.
Because we're talking 40 years ago, aren't we?
40 years ago. Yeah. Well, so they came to New York. I had a small apartment then. I could have put them up, but my aunt and uncle had a beautiful Upper East Side apartment on 81st and Lexington, and they put them up for like 10 days, and they stayed with them. They loved it. And then I get another letter from Michael Turkic. You don't know me, but... And I think he also stayed at my aunt and uncle's, and I think they were away. One of them... Now, I think Michael got to know them, but Ian and Leanne had the apartment themselves. They were like overwhelmed, and they became my best friends. So in 89, I thought I was doing some cruise ship work in Hawaii. I thought, I'm so close. Why don't I get some frequent flyer mileage and go to Australia? That was my first trip. And Michael took me around in Sydney. A guy hooked me up with Alex Wiltshire, who was an MD in doing Big River in Melbourne. And she put me in this beautiful big house in Melbourne. And I stayed with Guy and I think, and also Michael in Sydney. And we went to Adelaide to see Cats because Guy was MDing and Ian and Leanne were in it. And I remember watching the pit, being fascinated because... You know, are you blind when you're born? It sounds like there's going to be a fermata. But are you blind when you're born? And he kept conducting through the pauses because they had to know exactly how many counts. I went, oh, it's not a hold. It's actual counts because the dancers need to go, blind when you're born? 2, 3, 4. Can you see in the dark? I was like, oh, that makes sense. Right. Okay. It's fascinating being in the pit. And I learned so much. And that was Guy's start with Andrew Lloyd Webber. And his start conducting. And he became, as you in Australia know, the major conductor, musical director of Australia.
Absolutely. The go-to man for Miss Saigon. He goes all around the world.
And Phantom. He was in charge of Phantom. Yeah. And Love Never Dies, he worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber, even writing some music with Andrew on Love Never Dies, which I saw in Melbourne when he MD'd it. Yeah.
Most recently, did an arrangement for two pianos for Into the Woods, which was sensational.
Did he? Just two pianos?
Yeah.
And he put it together.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. You know, he did Forum with Jeffrey Rush in Melbourne, and Sondheim came to see it. And he told Sondheim the story of how we met, because I've known Sondheim since I was 18 years old. And Sondheim was like, that's bizarre. I said, yeah, I know, but now we're good friends, you know. It's funny.
Which is a lovely segue. How did you meet Stephen Sondheim?
Well, when I was 18, a student at Columbia, my friend said he really responds to letters. You write him a letter. So I wrote him a letter, and I didn't think anything of it. And on March 1st, 1980, if you can remember the dates, almost 34 years ago, I get a letter. It was a two-page, long letter. I addressed certain questions. Like, if you know the bassoon line from The Cut, Joanna from Sweeney Todd. Dum, bum, 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 bum. Of course, the song was gone, but I'd seen the show then, the original production. I said, I heard that vamp somewhere. And Sondheim wrote in the letter, no, I don't think so, you didn't. And then he said, I'm about to start work on a new show called Merrily Roll Along. We're casting it entirely with kids aged 12 to 16. That was their original idea.
12 to 16,
that was the original idea.
The final cast weren't 12 to 16.
No, they were a little older. But this was before he started writing it. Wow. That was the first idea.
Wow.
And he...
Suggested by Judy Prince, I think, that Hal do a show for
his kids.
For teenagers.
Well, he wanted to do it for Daisy, for their daughter. So Hal went to college with a guy whose son... It was James Weissenbach, and they said, why don't we put, and he and his friend went out to dinner and said, let's put our kids in the show. I'll put Daisy in the show, and I'll put Jim as the lead. And Jim was the original Franklin Shepherd, and I went to, I was doing a production of the Scottish play at Barnard when I was a freshman, sophomore, and I had auditioned for Merrily, as you can see in the documentary, the best worst thing that ever happened, singing Johnny One Note at my audition. But I met a girl who was playing Macduff in the show with a wig, you know, and she had gone to the audition. We started chatting. It turns out her mother, Carol Dorian, had gone to college with Jerry Herman and was his best friend and sang all of his backers' auditions over the years. So she was Jerry's goddaughter and inherited all the money and everything. But she's became a very, very dear friend of mine, and she started dating Jim Weissenbach. So I became very involved in hearing Jim would play us songs, but when they were just written, play us. I remember hearing Our Time before anybody, long before, because the show got postponed 6 months. And he got cast as Barnaby in the Carol Channing tour of Hello Dolly on the basis of the fact that he was going to be in the lead in the new Stephen Sondheim musical. And we all went, a bunch of the Merrily cast and I went to Westbury Music Fair to see Dolly. And he came out and wasn't all that. We were like, uh-oh. Sure enough, as people who know Merrily Rollong went, didn't quite work out. And after a week or two, he was replaced by Jim Walton. But in the interim, I'd gotten to know Sondheim and went over there and had really hit it off with him. And we would talk about all kinds of things. I brought a couple of various friends over the years to him, and I've run 100 letters from him, and then it became emails for a while. Actually, the last couple of years, I would send him sheet music to songs I thought he'd get a kick out of, and he usually wrote me back and said, Michael, I can't figure this out. I'm too old to play this. Can you sing this for me? So I would sing and make an MP3 and sing it to him, and he'd always have comments about Carolyn Lee. You know, Carolyn Lee wrote a show called Wildcat, which starred that great musical comedy star, Lucille Ball.
Basically, whoa, how you look me over.
Exactly, with Cy Coleman. And there's a cut song, fabulous song called, which I should do in the kindest cut, called Bouncing Back for More. It was actually done in Shirley MacLaine's act, so people who know that song. But it's a great song, and I sang it for Sondheim and sent it to him, and he wrote me back. I still have the email. Of course, I have the email. And he said, this is great. I can see some fixes, but of course, it's easy to see that when you're looking at a song from above. Carolyn Lee was a genius, and then he used the four-letter word I won't say in public company about a woman, that he said she was this, but she was a genius. So he would say
caustic.
Sometimes he would yell at me. I put out a CD where I sang a song called Life Begins with Love, which was written for the 1934 play Merrily Rollong, but not written for it. It was like used to advertise the play, but there was a cover with Merrily Rollong on it, and I thought I'd put that on. But I also sang Thank You for Coming. Thank You for Coming is a cut song from the Sondheim Merrily Rollong, which the joke of the show, you may know, having just seen it, is that Franklin Shepard could only write one song that went da 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 da. So this went, we're awfully glad that you came, we're glad you hear it, and you made it past the drunks. Now tell the waiter what everybody wants, or no, we're even gladder you're not at Julius Monk's, thank you for coming. So it was the same song, but sped up. And it was in previews, and I knew it really, really well. So I did, for the overture, I did a four-hand, maybe six-hand pass at it as an overture. And at the end of the show, I sang it on the show, on the CD. And he didn't respond about that. He said, he just yelled at me for singing the other Merrily. You just put that in there because you thought people would think it was from my show. And so I said, no, I sing this song that was cut from your show. And then he said, enough, Michael. And then in the next, anyway, the next email came a couple of days later. Anyway, I was wondering about this. And if you didn't know this, he would be really angry. And then he'd make up. And for example, you were talking about Rob Schneider has a podcast called Behind the Curtain. When I was first in it, on it, maybe 8 years ago, I said, in 1947, Sondheim wrote, for some reason I said a terrible musical, I don't know what possessed me, called Finney's Rainbow, Phinney. That was his college show at Williams, and there were published sheets. And I grabbed a song and played it for everybody and put it on the podcast. I didn't think, and a couple of weeks went by, I was actually teaching at WAPA in Perth, and one of my students came in and said, we just heard your podcast. I went, oh, it aired. Then I get an email the next day while I'm in Perth saying, Michael, a friend just sent me a podcast with you as guest in which you casually referred to Finney's Rainbow as a terrible show. Since no script exists, as far as I know, what's the basis for this dismissive opinion, Steve? And I was like, oh my God. So I apologized profusely. He said, you should be careful what you say. For example, you said I liked a show that Hal liked a show that I didn't. What are the composers were here, heard that, and, you know, be careful, Michael. I said, what you say. I said, yes, Steve, I'm so sorry.
What did you base that opinion on? Did you know the show or have access to
it? No, I just assumed it was a terrible show. I don't know why.
Because it didn't go anywhere.
There is no script. That's why Steve was saying there's no script. No. I don't know what the songs are actually for. It's 17 years old. Yeah. I sang a song in which he pays homage to all the question songs of Irving Berlin, of his youth, like, how much do I love you? I'll tell you now, how deep is the ocean? You know, songs that had all questions. So his song's called I Don't Know Why, and it's something like that. And it's all questions, and it's just very clever.
You are a font of knowledge, however. I mean, I've been to your apartment, and it is a receptacle for thousands and thousands and thousands of sheet music and libretto. Because you're a collector, you're an archivist, a sheet music historian, aren't you?
I have a problem saying no to collections, so that my apartment's kind of teeming at the edges. I have a storage room downstairs that's packed to the rafters, but there's a coach whose studio is right below us, actually, on 7th Avenue, named Bob Marks. He was the original coach for the Orphans and Annie in 1977, so he's been around a long time, and he wants to move to a studio a quarter of the size, and he has been collecting since the early 70s. So I took all his music, he gave it to me. There are 10 piles of sheet music under my television now that I need to get an assistant in to any of you Aussies coming to New York want to be my assistant, ring me up. I just need somebody to help put it in, figure out. A lot of it's duplicates, which I'll can sell on eBay or something. Like the Peter Allen song, there are two Peter Allen songbooks, both long out of print. And I have both of them, but now I have two copies of both of them, and I'm sure they'll go because they're things you don't see very much, and they have a lot of his songs. I get asked for a lot of Peter Allen songs, and I have Michael Tyak gave me the score to the Australian Boy from Oz, which is a different score, different arrangements, and some different songs from what Hugh Jackman did. So I have both scores, and sometimes, you know, I get asked, people know, I guess, that I have this large collection of sheet music, and I get around 5, 10, 15 requests a day from around the world looking for that piece of sheet music. If they're ringing me from Australia, I say, can you put $5 in my account at Commonwealth? But, you know, here I do it with a Venmo or PayPal.
A Europeanist, of course. But, yes. But otherwise, what is the fascination with sheet music? Why do you collect it?
Yeah, and I like having the actual sheet music. Very few people know what sheet music is today because they get it on a PDF. They buy it on Music Notes or something like that. But I like having these beautiful covers and being able to open up a piece of sheet music. For example, I'm often asked to play a new show. And they say, we're going to send you some MP3s. I said, can you send me the sheet music? Because I'd rather learn it by playing it and sight singing it and going, that's how it goes. And maybe then listening to an MP3 to see if I'm totally wrong. But I love learning new music. I haven't played 1/100th of the music in my apartment, and I haven't scanned. I scan something when I get asked for it, and it hasn't been scanned yet. So I have a lot of things that haven't been scanned, particularly older things. But when somebody needs something like from Kimberly Akimbo or...
Well, Shocked. I know that personally that nothing delights you more than being able to provide some sheet music for a particular song. I remember when I was at Whopper, and I'd heard on Lost in Boston 10%, which was cut from Chicago. Michael, would you have 10%?
Did I fax it to you? Or
Yes, it was the olden days.
Remember so
it was
fax? Doing fax, everybody remember fax
machines? Well, you tied it to a pigeon and
that's
it flew
exactly
to Australia.
What I did.
But you had it.
Because my mentor was a man named Peter Howard. Peter Howard wrote the dance music to Chicago and Crazy for You and Hello Dolly and Annie and Baby and Barnum and Carnival, and he MD'd many of those shows too. And I loved him, and he did 10% all the time. He would go to little like open mic nights and get up and sing it because he knew it. It was a song that was cut that nobody knew because the character was cut. There was the character of the agent, Velma's agent, that got cut. And that was the song about I'm a theatrical agent. And that's, you know, fun. And Peter wrote the Roxy Vamp. I recently have spent a lot of time. I live across the street from Lincoln Center and from Juilliard specifically, but I've been living in this apartment almost 34 years, and it's only the past couple of years that I remembered that I'm next to the Library of Performing Arts. We're on the third floor, the vaunted third floor special collections. They have the papers of anybody you can think of. So the first person I looked up was Julius Monk, who you may not know who he was. He had these, the upstairs of the dance studios, these reviews in the 50s and 60s, and I had a lot of his material. Then I decided to go to Fred Ebb. Fred Ebb had 50, 60 boxes, and you have a finding aid where you can look up, go, well, I'll get box 3, 7, 13, 24, 35, and they have a library cart with all the boxes. You can take one at a time. You open up, and you go, oh, my God, and you can scan to your heart's content. So I have the original Roxy, went, the name on everybody's lips is gonna be Roxy. It was a bump, 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 and it was lots of different lyrics that I can show you sometime if you ever want to hear them, all the whole other choruses that you don't know. So Peter told me that Bob Fosse said, we need to slow that song way, way, way down. Peter, we need some kind of hook. And Peter will come up with all kinds of ideas. And bump, one of his, bump, that was one of his bump, ideas. Bump, so Peter bump, was known bump, for writing the Roxy Vamp, and which I said when I introduced him at shows, he did something with me at Joe's Pub.
And he was responsible for Hot Honey Rag, too, I guess.
He created the Hot Honey Rag. Definitely his work. Absolutely, without a doubt. And I went to see Old Friends, the Sondheim review, a couple of weeks ago in London. And I'm good friends with Bonnie Langford. You know the name Bonnie Langford was the original Baby June?
Was she employed?
No, she was the original. That's Bonnie Franklin.
Franklin. Oh.
Bonnie Langford was the original. She's English. She's the original.
Oh, yeah. She recently did 42nd Street.
Correct. She was the original Baby June, though, in the Angela Lansbury Gypsy in London. And came to the States. She was one of Doctor Who's companions. She's a big star in London, has done and done a lot of things. 15 years ago, she did a one-woman show that I MD'd here at 59th Street. So we became good friends. She still does. She's like 59. She does splits. I mean, completely out in Old Friends. And Janie D, another big star in London. 30 years ago, I played for her for the Vivian Ellis Awards, these awards. And I went backstage and was schmoozing with them. Bernadette Peters walks in. It's clear she loves them. She's clear that they love me. So she's like talking to me. I've helped her with sheet music over the years. I've even met her a couple of times. But the first thing I said to her was, I know that you know Peter Howard. She lit up. She went, Peter Howard was instrumental in my career because he conducted Gypsy and I played Dainty June when I was 13 years old. So I said the right thing and she got a photo with me. She was so sweet. But Lea Salongo was truly the revelation in that production. Anybody in the audience who is a potential producer was thinking, oh my goodness, we have to get up productions of Gypsy, Passion, and Sweeney Todd, because her Worst Pies in London, her I Don't Can't Believe I Love You, whatever thing from Passion, and her Everything's Coming Up Roses were fantastic. I mean, I can't even tell you.
I agree. She came to Australia and did a concert at the
Did she do any of those?
At the Opera House. Broad repertoire.
So impressed with her, I can't even tell you.
And her brother was the conductor.
Right, I knew her brother conductor.
But she's an extraordinary talent, yeah.
She was it for me. But Gavin Lee, who was the original Bert and Mary Poppins here and also did SpongeBob, he did, for believe it or not, Could I Leave You? And it was brilliant. I mean, every beat you could see, he had thought through everything, and it was zipping along at the right tempo with the full orchestra. And I've given him sheet music, but I've only met him once or twice. I didn't know he came in. He was like, Michael Levine. I was like, oh my God, you know me. And he remembered me, and he hugged me. I was like, you were it. I mean, everything in the show is directed by Julia McKenzie and Matthew Bourne, co-directed by them. Every song, you could see they really took it apart and say, let's get this. This beat's not working. There was never a false note. And I'm so wary. I was saying, all right, show me. When I was in the third row center, I was like, this is going to be whatever. And I was like, I was hooked from the beginning. And I was ready not to like it. So I was very pleasantly surprised. I hope they bring it up over to the States.
Of course, everything in performing a song is within the text, isn't it?
It's all there, but people don't do it.
Picking up the cues from the music, exactly. Too, about how to deliver that text.
That's exactly right, Pete. That's exactly what I felt they were doing. Yeah. They had really examined things. I had worked
sometimes, especially didn't he?
Well, sometimes, especially wrote for actors, yeah. You know, if you do the work, it'll all be there for you. And so many songs, like Janie did, the boy from, you know. Because I'm about to go to Rio, so I'm staying in Ipanema. I think I'm looking for the girl, you know. But it was so well done. I was so impressed with how I just thought. And Julia and I had worked together almost 24 years ago with the musical Honk about the Ugly Duckling, yep, by George Stiles and Anthony Drew, who were kind of ish proteges of Sondheim. And I was playing the auditions, and the day of the auditions, Kimberly Grigsby, who's a major Broadway MD, as MD of Days of Wine and Roses, she got Full Monty, the very, very first production in San Diego of Full Monty, so she had to back out. They liked me, Drew and Stiles knew me, and they hired me, and I MD'd it. And Julia and I were dealt with the casting. I loved her, excited. And we had one of the actors had done an earlier production, and they were really trying to sell us on him. And he was doing a national tour of fame, and he was in Hawaii, and he filmed in his hotel balcony with the ocean. He started singing a cappella, and Julia and I looked at each other, Gavin Creel, we have to use him as Ugly. So Gavin Creel, when he was 24, he was in Honk with us. And all the London choreographer, the London set designer, the London costume designer, they all came over from the production at the National that they'd done. And it was a big success. We had Nancy Opel from the original Sunday in the Park. We had major, major people in it. It was a great, great experience. And I remember I went to the ASCAP workshop one day, and Sondheim was the guest. This is where they have composers working on new material, and Stephen Schwartz runs it, and there's always three or four guests. But when it's Sondheim, it's only Sondheim and Stephen. And Sondheim is waving, and I turn around to see who he's waving at, and I look back, and he's like, no, I'm looking at you. I was like, you are? It's like, oh, I was just talking about you. I was like, you were just talking about me? I said to Paul McKibbins, who's his publisher, he went, no, not him. I said, Julia McKenzie. I went, oh, because I'm doing Honk. And we had a great chat about that. Just too funny, a million years ago.
Well, you're, of course, a vocal coach. Is that what you call yourself?
Yes.
Of renown. So what are the essentials when somebody comes to you, a student or an actor who's learning a song for the first time? What are the essentials which you teach or consider that they need to know?
Well, a lot of the essentials come with choosing the right material. People choose material that's too negative, too losery. I say, there's a term in Australia and England called high stakes. In the States, we call it, I say, investing your song with a sense of urgency. Why do I have to get this song out in the next 2 minutes, and what's going to happen if I don't? And I've been teaching at all the unis and the cons in Australia now, helping them find the right songs to sing for auditions, because people sing passive songs, not active songs. So I want them to sing songs where they're in a situation. My go-to situation for you would be like, see that girl, that boy, there, she's really hot, but I think she likes my best friend. I don't know what I'm going to do about that. So you have to solve a problem in your song. Very few songs are going to be that specific, but I will always say to you, what is your action? What are you doing in this song? And what can you? How can you make that more active in your song? So it's not just listen to my pretty voice and there's nothing going on with the lyric. Mm-hmm. So I try to get them to really pay attention to the lyric and make it where I'm not looking at them like, you're thinking about you're doing your laundry tonight. You're not tapped into the song.
Yes, I think it was Hammerstein who said, treat a song like a one-act play.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Think of every beat. Really take the song apart and say, that poor section doesn't work. I don't believe you. You've got to rethink that or change the key.
How long have you been doing that? You must have coached thousands of students.
I never thought about it, but I'm sure it is, because I've been doing it for 40 years since I graduated from uni 40 years ago.
So you studied piano at uni?
No, I was an English literature major.
Okay, right.
I did take piano lessons my last year, but music was the other thing. I wanted to act. I went in for auditions as an actor. And
is that what brought you to New York?
Columbia University. I went to school here, but after I graduated, I decided I wanted to stay, and I typed very fast, so I would temp at offices typing and then run home to coach or run home or get jobs out of town and do jobs. And then finally the jobs came up enough that I could give up the temping after a number of years. But I was doing a lot of jobs out of town and in town too back in the 80s, you know.
I'm so envious of New Yorkers because you have the opportunity to attend the theater every week as many times as you'd like. I know now that it's probably a bit cost prohibitive.
There are always ways to find cheaper seats. Almost every show has a rush or a lottery. The lottery's tough because if you're applying for the lottery for Hamilton, you're applying with around 5,000-10,000 other people, and chances are it's only $10 if you get it and you're right down front, but chances are you're not going to get it. But rush means, like for Back to the Future, I heard they had a rush for $30, $40, and you go by before the box office opens. So I got there around 9:15 for 10 o'clock opening. I was like number 18. I knew like the first 20 people were going to get in, even though they were each getting two tickets because they had that many tickets. Sure enough, got for $40, I got a great seat. And I saw just now Dracula Comedy of Terrors, this play that got all the buzz off Broadway. It was completely sold out for the run, but they had a rush. And I went down at 12:15 for the 1 o'clock opening of the box office. Nobody there. And I thought, oh my God, they're not going to have tickets. Sure enough, got a ticket for $35, two tickets.
Wow.
Went with a friend.
So there are ways.
There are ways with almost every show. Something like Merrily's going to be tough, but because it's selling out. If they're sold out, like Wicked, you're not going to get a cheap seat. Or sometimes they do.
So in that 40 years of being here, you have attended many, many productions.
Lots of shows.
Original productions of musicals that now become classics and revivals, of course. What are some of the shows which stand out for you in that 40-year?
Certainly the original Sweeney Todd. I saw it when it first opened in April. It opened in March of 79. I went in April with my family. And then when I went to Columbia, I went in December of 79. Sondheim saw it as a very small show, like a chamber piece. But Hal Prince saw it as an enormous show. The set was massive, and it was a 23-piece orchestra, and it was a very, very big thing. Not what Sondheim had envisioned, but it was...
But he eventually got his wish.
He got the smaller productions, first in 89 and over the years. But my second time seeing it, in December of 79, I went to the 50th Street subway stop station, waiting for the train, realized I'm standing amongst all the ensemble of Sweeney Todd. I started chatting with them, and this man comes up to me and says, "Well, dear boy, I give voice lessons if you'd like to study with me." And that was Joaquin Romaguera, the original Pirelli in Sweeney Todd. So I started studying with Joaquin. He lived up at 103rd and Riverside. I would play piano for his other students, so he'd give me half-price lessons. So instead of $50 in 1980, I'd get them for $25. And then I would go to the stage door. The three dressing rooms upstairs were Joaquin, Ed Lindeck, who was the original Judge Turpin, and Ken Jennings, who was the original Tobias. And I would hang out with the three of them before the show. The first time, he said, "Oh, come with me, dear boy." And he had me stand behind a pillar. And if I went out and moved my head, I'd be in complete view of the audience. He said, "I'll be right back." And he's saying, "Sing your razor high," to the end of the show. And it was incredible. The times I went to Len Cariou and Angela Lansbury's last performance. That was the first time. My friend, right before the show, he nudged me and said, "Look over there." I went, "Oh my God, it's Stephen Sondheim." It's the first time I ever saw him, and he was like 49 yet. Uh-huh. And I remember going backstage to Len's dressing room, and outside Len's dressing room were all these stars, Eartha Kitt, all these famous people, and Sondheim. And I went up to him and introduced myself. That's when I wrote the letter after meeting him there.
Uh-huh. Edmund Lindeck is a character actor who's always fascinated me.
Ed was a friend. I knew him.
Did that great Judge Turpin, of course, but then pops up in Into the Woods just as Cinderella's father.
Correct. And he was in A Doll's House, which is... No, A Doll's Life, which is the sequel to A Doll's House. Lyrics and book by Comden and Green, music by Larry Grossman, starred Betsy Joslin. Betsy Joslin took over for Sarah Rice as the original Joanna. We just lost Sarah Rice last week. Oh. Yeah, 69. She was the original Joanna. And Betsy was... Sarah was understudying Betsy as the girl in the Fantastics right before they both got Sweeney Todd. And Betsy was the lead in A Doll's House, Doll's Life, with Edmund Lindeck as a character in the show. And I saw Ed do a production of Man of La Mancha that was directed by Jack Eric Williams. Do you know that name? Jack Eric Williams is the original Beatle in Sweeney Todd. Huh? They did it in Nashville. A friend of mine was playing Sancho Panza, and I went down to see him, and I became friendly with Ed. And he lived to be into his 90s. He would go to these ASCAP workshops, and I would get him to sign some of my sheet music, and he was loved him. Funny. So I got to play Hal Prince for a year, for a time. My friend and I would go to Sweeney so many times. We'd always go, and we'd go up to the dressing room before the show, because back then there was no security. You could go. Yeah. They'd say, "Oh, you back again? Go ahead, go see Joaquin." And Ed, we said, "Ed, would you do that thing you do for tonight?" So if you know Sweeney Todd pretty well, folks, you remember when the judge is almost killed, and he goes down the steps muttering. Rah, rah, rah. Yeah, yeah. So when we said to do that thing, he would go down the steps muttering, "She says she'll marry her Sunday. That's what she says." He would do that for us, and we were like, "We played Hal Prince for a day. I wish I had told Hal Prince that." That was my Hal Prince moment.
Did you know Hal?
I met him a lot, and every time I said the same thing, that I was a dear, dear friend of Hugh Martin. Hugh Martin wrote Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Clang, Clang, Clang with the Trolley, The Boy Next Door. He was a dear friend of mine, lived in Encinitas, and he had his own television series in the 50s, and the gopher, the assistant, like the one who got coffee, was Hal Prince when he was young. So every time I met him, a lot, stupidly, I would start talking about Hugh. And he'd go, "What a wonderful man!" And he'd just go on and on about Hugh Martin. And we never got to talk about all the things I wanted to talk to him about.
Yeah.
You know, everything. Sweeney, these stories I'm telling you.
Yeah.
And I even went to Prince of Broadway with my sister. And our friend, my good friend James Gray, was the associate choreographer, and he's standing all the way in the back of the orchestra on the other side, waving to us, going, "Come over here after the show." So we went, and he opens the door and says, "This is Hal Prince." I went, "Oh." And first thing out of my mouth, "Hugh Martin." And then he died, and I didn't get to talk to him about anything else, so that was too bad. Yeah.
So Sweeney Todd is vivid in your memory. What other shows do you recall which...
It's funny, I you wouldn't think this, but I was talking about Bring Back Birdie, the sequel to Bye Bye Birdie, because I saw it seven times, but there was a song called Don't Say F-A-T in front of Conrad, because it was about Fat Elvis, you know, then, and I can picture being at that show. It wasn't a terrific moment, the best show in the world. It was not a good show, but the score was good. Sometimes good shows, good scores exist in shows that are just awful. For example, the sequel to The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas was called The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public. And it's a great score. I'm actually working now with Leonard Machen, whose wife was Carol Hall, who wrote the score to Best Little Whorehouse Public and in Texas. And we're working to put it together, a Carol Hall songbook, to just send out for free to any singers who want them, because she wrote wonderful songs.
Yeah.
The score in Whorehouse Goes Public is fantastic, but I saw a rehearsal in another theater, no sets, no costumes, no orchestration, just piano, and it looked great. Apparently, when I went off to London to do my first of four shows in London, and apparently they glitzed it up with millions of dollars, Bob Mackie gowns, tacky sets, everything. It was trounced. It was just vilified in the press and closed quickly. And I was like, "Oh, what I saw was..." And I did a concert of it around 15 years ago, and I asked Carol to come. It was such a sore subject for her. She didn't want to come, her husband told me. Yet we solved all the problems, because it was just done in a little, like at the Duplex. We did it downtown in a little bar. And you saw what the show was. It wasn't a great show, but it was a lot better than it deserved.
Did you ever see Rags?
I did. I saw it originally. Lonnie Price was in it originally.
Right, it only ran through.
It only ran a couple of performances,
yeah.
And they had a big rally. The whole cast, Lonnie brought the whole cast and anybody in the audience or passersby down to the TKTS booth to try to keep the show going. Or things like that never really work, but they were trying. Rags was troubled out of town, though. They fired the director, Joan McLynn Silver, who was a film director, directed a wonderful movie called Hester Street, but she wasn't really a theater director. They fired her, and then eventually Stephen Schwartz started directing because he was the lyricist. And yeah, I think it was just a mess. They didn't really... Yet it had been kicking around for years.
It's a magnificent score, I think.
They'd done so many workshops of it, and you're right, it's a wonderful score, and I don't know why. Yet now they've fiddled around even more. Stephen's rewritten songs. They have the book rewritten, even though Joe Stein has passed away. They're working on the book, working on new things. Charles, I think, did some interesting things with the music, and so did arrangers. And I've seen some workshops, and they did it at Goodspeed, this new version. Different song order, different song, people singing different songs. And apparently it worked. They say it works much, much better, so I look forward. I hope something... They thought of it as an unofficial sequel to Fiddler on
Fiddler.
The Roof.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Fiddler finishes, of course, with the Jewish community exiting the pogroms.
Going into rags. About to arrive in New York and be in rags, right. Exactly.
Going on tour.
It's true, I know.
We spoke earlier off mic about Merrily We Roll Along, which is the hottest ticket on Broadway at the moment. Great irony, considering that it was one of sometimes biggest flops, and he wasn't going to continue as a writer for a while after that flop. You saw Merrily? I know you auditioned for it.
I saw it 10 times because I went, tickets were cheap back then, so I stood online.
Well, you only had 44 previews, a lot of previews, and 16 performances.
Correct. Yeah. And I saw, because I got there at 9 o'clock in the morning, the box office opened at noon, tickets were cheap, so I bought $266 worth of tickets at the day the box office opened, which were a lot of tickets because tickets were not, the most expensive ticket was like $25 or something, and I got a lot of, maybe 35, and I got a lot of tickets, and I ended up going... I went opening night. I went to the last preview. I went to a performance that was supposed to be the last preview, and then they postponed it a week. And I was sitting right behind Paul Gimignani, and sacrilege to say this, but I was recording the show each of those times. And this was a beautiful recording right behind the conductor. That sounds like a record, kind of the show. And sometimes I saw 10 completely different performances. I was telling somebody else about this the other day. They put in an orchestration, a different orchestration for old friends. One night, it was a counter melody while they're singing, "Hey, old friends," the orchestra, the big band, the kind of a big band arrangement with saxophones that were playing, ba-dum-bum-bum-ba-da-dum-bum, and it went in for one night, and the next night, it was out, and I happened to be recording it that one night. And I'm glad I have these recordings, because this is part of history. Jonathan Tunick lives around the corner from me, and I've seen him a lot, and I wonder if he remembers any of this. But the show was fascinating to see all the changes go into it.
And they just get it right.
And then we all stood, opening night, we all stood on line on stage to greet Sondheim and tell him what a wonderful job and how it's all come together and it's all working now. And he was like, yep, right, whatever. But then I got a letter. I was writing a paper. I was taking a course in 1930s literature. And I was writing a paper comparing the 1934 Kaufman and Hart play to what they did. And I called him and I kind of asked, I guess I asked him why it was a flop or something. And he said, I was about to go to spend my junior year in London. And he said, Michael, have a good time in London. I'll talk to you when I get back. But then he wrote me a letter. We corresponded while I was in London. He said, I never want to work in New York again. Certainly not in the theater, or maybe off-Broadway or off-Broadway. And he did. He worked next to the show. It was off-Broadway, Sunday in the Park with George, which I saw twice at Playwrights Horizons. The second time was one of three performances where they did a second act. And it was a completely different second act than what made it to Broadway. The piece that they did, the Chromalume, was like a Robert Wilson. If you know Robert Wilson, yes, the performance artist, it was like with Bernadette Peters holding her diary and going... or holding a book up, looking around, going, have you seen a diary? It was very avant-garde and weird. I kind of liked it. I kind of liked it more than what exists now, which is, again, something I can't tell James Lapine. But I was fascinated to see, lucky enough to get in to see that one of those three last performances, because he was still writing and they put it in.
Yeah.
And then I also went to one of the first performance on Broadway, where they made an announcement that they were not going to use microphones. You heard all of us around 200 people in the audience with their little tape recorders going, no! Because you wouldn't hear a thing. It was acoustic. And after like the first couple performances, when the audience couldn't hear anything because they weren't using mics and there was an orchestra playing, they added mics back in.
Well, we can be grateful to cast recordings, and that wonderful cast recording produced by Thomas Shepard of Merrily We Roll Along has certainly kept the memory of that show alive, and through the various incarnations that have happened.
And I'll tell Tom you called him out, because he's become my new Facebook friend, and we're talking about getting together. I so want to meet him, because he's the history of musical theater, so many records.
So responsible for those records, and features prominently, I think it's Follies in Concert.
That's right, which I went to.
Oh, you saw that?
I did.
That's a phenomenal recording.
Because if
well.
You remember, Comden and Green did Rain on the Roof.
They did.
And I did a show with a guy I went to college with named Noel Katz, a composer. We did a show called On the Brink. And right around the time, we were starting rehearsals the day after Follies in Concert was on. And we were looking at the photos after the auditions, and I went, I know those teeth. The Greens have two children, Adam and Amanda. That's Adolph Green's daughter. So we cast Amanda Green, who's now a very well-respected, terrific Broadway lyricist, having written High Fidelity, Bring It On, Hands on a Hard Body, Mr. Saturday Night with Jason Robert Brown, lots of shows, and she has a lot of shows in the works, too. And we've done a lot of concerts together. We're doing another one. She's going to be in this Charles Kirsch concert in April about the Joe Allen posters. Shows from the songs from the shows that were on the walls at Joe Allen's, all the flop musicals. Yeah. But Amanda was in this show, and Adolph Green and Phyllis Newman came to our opening night. And years later, I had a student who was reading the newspaper to Adolph Green every day. And she called me because he had macular degeneration. He couldn't see. He'd be seen walking on the street, and people would go, Mr. Green, you're about to walk into that car in the street and grab him. So she said, do you want to go? And I said, yes. And I went, he said, you want to go into the piano room? I went, okay. So we started playing, and I had the best time in the world in their amazing apartment, the Beresford. And he said, well, now how much do I owe you? And I said, no, I have to pay you. He said, oh. But then we became friends because I live across the street from where Betty Comden lived, and Adolph would call me, and I have 14 messages from him in which he'd say things like, Michael, it's Adolph. I'm over at Betty's. It's raining out. Can I come over? I'd be like, yes, come over. And he'd kibitz with my last student of the day, and we'd talk, and we'd have wonderful, wonderful times together. I loved my time. He'd say, Michael, we're going to a show tonight. I don't know. It's called The Beauty Queen of Lenan. And then we were in the second row because he had to sit front. And he was saying, now, did she just kill him? I said, yes, Adolph, she just killed him because he couldn't see. He said, Michael, I want to go to La Chinoise with you. La Chinoise is Shun Li, which is a very top Chinese restaurant right near me in Lincoln Center. And we go there. And one of the times we went there, this man comes up to us and says, are you the Adolph Green? And he said, well, I'm an Adolph Green. He said, well, I'm the Joseph Heller. Joseph Heller wrote Catch 22, you know, the book, a famous author. Yeah. And he sat with us and chatted. Another time, Adolph and I were sitting next to Julia Roberts. And I said, do you know her? Can we talk to her? He said, no, I don't know her. We can't talk to her. I said, okay. But the time with Adolph, I treasure. 2 days ago, Nick Blamire came over to my apartment. Have you seen Maestro?
Yes, I have.
Nick Blamire plays Adolph Green in Maestro. You know, there's a scenes... There are actually several scenes, party, but most of them are on the cutting room floor. I said the movie was 3 hours, and he showed me that they sang Reader's Digest also, which didn't make it to the movie. But he wants to do something, so he came over. We looked
at Carried Away, didn't they?
They sang Carried Away, exactly. So I showed him, played him all my messages of Adolph, and you know, we'll see what happens with that. Maybe something will happen in the future.
Real pinch yourself moments.
It's great.
So does every show receive a cast recording now?
No, in fact, I have a friend named Robert Scher, S-H-E-R. You probably want to interview him. He's a record producer, been around for over 45 years. He produced the record of The Baker's Wife, the original record of Baker's Wife. He produced, more recently, he produced the record of The Music Man with Hugh Jackman and Sutton Foster, Patti LuPone's Gypsy, Nice Work If You Can Get It, the Daniel Radcliffe How to Succeed. But he also recorded in the 80s and 90s things like Bring Back Birdie. I met him at the recording session for Bring Back Birdie when Lee Adams, who was my professor at the time, looked up and went, one of my students is here, you know, because I got invited to the recording session. He also in records of Doll's Life, I was talking about, Oh Brother, tons of musicals. And he often gets asked to be put something together, but nowadays you need the money. And if you can't find money people, like right now he's trying to get both Spamalot, the current production of Spamalot, and Titanic, which is terrific, recorded. And he's trying to raise the money for them. And we'll see whether that happens. Maybe when you hear this, they may have recorded one of those by then, but he hasn't gotten the money together, so they may not. Neither of them may happen, but that's why records don't get recorded. Something like that.
The increase in popularity, is there an audience to buy them?
Nobody buys CDs anymore because nobody has CDs. It's only MP3s, and there's no way of making money because MP3s, you're making, you know, pennies. Yes. You're not making any money. So they still get made. I have a friend who has a recording studio. He is constantly overbooked. He's packed because everybody wants to record things. I don't know what platform they're putting them out on, but records are still being made. Robert's also talking about doing a record of Gutenberg with Josh Gad and Andrew Rannells.
Because it's in the best interest of the creatives. To,
maybe,
to
but Spamalot, there was a recording
there
of Spamalot.
Yes,
and we don't know if they need another one with stars in it, really. Michael Urie, you know, some of the people, but... I don't know if you need another recording of Spamalot. Titanic is terrific, and I would say that would be a good thing. But some of these CDs don't need to be made again, right. Especially when they've already been made. Like, do you need to hear Nicole Scherzinger do Sunset Boulevard? Yeah. I mean, she sings it well, but there's already Glenn Close or Betty Buckley or Patti LuPone, whoever made it originally.
Yeah, yeah. But no Faye Dunaway.
No Faye Dunaway. And Patti LuPone also was let go, you remember?
Yes, exactly.
I saw Patti LuPone in it, and... couldn't really understand her, but she was great. But then I went to opening night of Betty Buckley. She was amazing. This is, yeah, again 30 years ago almost. Yeah. 30 years ago this year, yeah.
On Broadway?
In London, the West End.
London, okay.
Before it came to, it was Glenn Close on Broadway.
Right. So what's coming to Broadway in 2024 that you know? There's all sorts of marquees going up around.
You know that I hear the most buzz about is The Notebook. It's by Ingrid Michaelson, the pop singer.
And being arranged by Carmel Dean.
Is she doing the arrangements?
Yes.
Is she MDing or just doing arrangements?
I think she's certainly working on it at the moment. So
great.
It might be a bit of
Have everything. You asked her about it?
No, we're catching up next
great,
week.
Great, because so. I want to know everything. I know I got... There's some recordings floating around and somebody had one of the songs taken down and did it in a cabaret with me and it was terrific. So I hear great buzz about that. It played out of town. A lot of these things, you know, Merrily never went out of town. It came right to New York for previews, and they said maybe they would have gotten the kinks out and learned what was wrong had they gone out of town, but it's very expensive. I saw Mean Girls out of town in D.C. I saw Beetlejuice out of town in D.C. I used to go to Seattle. I saw the Wedding Singer, I think, something. Shrek. I saw Shrek in Seattle. A lot of shows do go out of town, but... a lot of shows come in pretty cold, and there's also jockeying for theaters. You're going to be hearing about a show. I'll give you a little scoop, and it played off Broadway a couple of years ago. It's called Cagney, about the life of Jimmy Cagney. Definitely. Played front 2 years off Broadway a number of years ago.
As well as a bad guy, he was quite an accomplished tap dancer.
Absolutely, and this is obviously a tap show. Bobby Creighton, Robert Creighton, is a wonderful tapper. Was in Frozen as like the little king, the little kind of funny guy, and he was also in The Anything Goes with Sutton Foster. Tons of Broadway shows. Old friend of mine, 30 years, from Canada. And he's going to play Jimmy. He's played Jimmy Cagney and continue to play Jimmy Cagney. My good friend Ricky Kane Larimer is a producer who championed Cagney off Broadway and is now in the process of arranging to bring it to Broadway. And it's probably going to be here in the fall. Josh Burgas is a very successful choreographer. He's going to direct and choreograph. And it's going to be a big thing. So you'll be hearing about it. They have a big meeting this week. We'll see what happens.
One of my favorite clips on YouTube, which never fails to make me smile, is that wonderful, I think it's the Seven Little Foys, but Bob Hope and James Cagney dancing on the tables.
Exactly.
It's iconic.
They have all this kind of dancing in this show. It's great choreography. Original score. Some songs you know, but by and large, an original score by Christopher McGovern that's really nice. And I'm excited about it. So that's something else to think about that's coming. You'll hear more things like when Shucked... once a show announced it's closing, now that Kimberly Akimbo's announced they're closing, everybody's jockeying trying to get into the Booth Theater because it's a very desirable theater because it's smaller. If you have a smaller show, you want to get in that theater. So I don't think these theaters are going to stay dark for very long. They're now planning to bring the Sunset Boulevard from London over to Broadway, and I think I just saw it and I thought it was good. It was very inexpensive, shall we say, because it was no set, just a camera, and there's no staircase, no nothing. And some of it, they filmed the title song, the top of the second act, he's in his dressing room, and then he starts singing it in his dressing room, and he goes and you see Nicole Scherzinger, and she's like, oh, don't look at me. And then he's singing it, he's going down the staircase, singing, bum, 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 bum. And he goes outside, walks along the Strand, comes into the where the Savoy Theater is, goes into the theater, while he's singing all this time, goes down the steps in the Savoy, and then bursts through the theater at the end, after the key change, and back up to the theater. Stage to do it. It's a choice,
Well, it's bringing a new perspective to a show which is firmly planted in everyone's psyche.
Right.
I mean, I crave the day to see a new production of Chicago, for example.
Oh, I'd love to see a real production, not a concert version, but we have to wait. Someday this will close. The other thing I saw in London that I think was terrific was Stranger Things. If you know the TV show, you know Stephen Daldry is the director.
Yeah.
They spent millions of pounds on this production. It looks gorgeous. The reviews were less than I thought they'd be. I saw a preview. I thought it was brilliant. Knowing the TV series as I do, but also the actors, Lauren Ward is an American married to Matthew Warchus, the famous London director, is in it. And just great actors, and I thought it was great. I think it's got a bright future. We'll see.
Well, Michael Levine, it's been wonderful catching up with you in New York. When are you back in Australia?
Hopefully soon. Hopefully, as soon as I can get there.
That's always the case. We catch up and we don't draw breath. And more conversation will continue off mic, I'm sure. But thank you so much for joining Stages.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you, Michael, for that terrific conversation and a great catch-up in New York City. And folks, if you happen to be in New York City on those dates, do check out Michael's new show. I'm Peter Eyers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.